Morning, everyone. Just occurred to me that I probably should introduce myself every so often. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Tim. I used to be a pastor here for quite a long time. I'm now a lecturer at the Baptist Bible College, and you can mostly find me hanging out at the 6 p.m. service, which is why you may think, who's this strange person standing up to preach? But they get me back for non-ratings period every so often, so there you go. Let me pray as we come to this wonderful passage of Scripture in Hebrews chapter 11. Father God, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the examples of all those who've gone before us, who inspire us, people we've just been singing about. And we thank you mostly for the example of your Son in whose footsteps we're called to follow. Help us to do that better today, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, I know this morning we've got a lot of school-aged kids here. So put up your hand if you're in school at the moment. Yeah, well, there's a few there. I'll encourage you to put up your hand, because if you put up your hand, you'll get a marshmallow. Ah, a few more hands go. John, you are well past school, I'm sorry. So keep your hand up if you like marshmallows, because Colin and Pamela are going to come around and give you one. Okay, so keep your hand up. I didn't have enough for everyone, sorry, I would have done this for everyone, but my marshmallow budget didn't quite stretch. Now, when you get the marshmallow, right, don't eat it. Right? Just wait for a second, because you have a choice. You need to listen carefully. You can eat it straight away if you want. It will be your choice. But if you wait until the end of the service without eating it, so just before the last song, you will get a second marshmallow. Right? So you can have one now and that'll be it, or you can hold on to it and wait and get two near the end. Your choice, okay? This is, in fact, a famous experiment done in the 1960s, back at Stanford University. It was run to test our capacity to delay gratification or to deny ourselves in the short term in order to get something of a greater long-term benefit. Still got a hand down this side, just letting you know there. And here's a short video of a more recent running of this experiment with, I think you'll agree, some very cute kids. So let's have a look at this.
Okay, sit in that chair. All right, here's the deal. Marshmallow, for you. You can either wait, and I'll give you another one if you wait, or you can eat it now. When I come back, I'll give you another one, so then you'll have two. But stay in here and stay in the chair till I come back, okay?
Okay.
All right. I'm gonna go do something and then I'll come back.
It smells yummy. Oh, it smells really good. How'd you do? Did you do good? You did? Yeah.
You wanted to eat it, didn't you? Yeah. So did I tell you I'd give you another one? Okay, now you can have both. You need them.
Ah, yes. It was tough for them to wait, wasn't it? Yeah, you can see them trying to avoid looking at it. They tasted bits. They almost ate, then they stopped themselves. Even as adults, it's difficult to deny yourself something now, even when there's something far better on offer later. How are we doing? Is anyone actually, have you still got yours? Anyone eaten theirs yet? I can see plenty of marshmallows being held up. That's excellent. So you've got about half an hour to go, right? See how you go. But this, believe it or not, is the background to the book of Hebrews that we're looking at this morning. Not the marshmallow bit, but the delay of gratification bit. Denying yourself something now because there is something far better on offer in the future. The first hearers of this letter were a marginalized minority. They were being persecuted for their faith in Jesus. Some of it was physical, being put in prison. Some of it was economic, having property and employment taken away from them. And all of it was social, being marginalized, being excluded, and above all, being shamed, being scorned for daring to be different, daring not to go along with what everyone else was doing. In Hebrews 10, it says, "Remember those earlier days. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. You suffered along with those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions." The temptation for this first audience, the marshmallow that was sitting in their hand, if you like, the temptation for them was to go back to being Jews under the old covenant, to give up on the Jesus thing, or at least being all that public about it, and to go back to being like everyone else. And for them, this promised an end to their persecution, an end to their marginalization. Their fellow Jews would accept them once more. And the Roman Empire wouldn't persecute them for not worshipping the emperor as a god, since the Jews had kind of done a special deal with Rome so they didn't have to. So for them to go back to being Jewish, to fit in with everyone else, it was the easy way. It was the path of least resistance. Like the marshmallow of acceptance by everyone else could be eaten now if they chose. But of course, that meant on giving up on Jesus. And the writer to the Hebrews wanted to convince them that giving up on Jesus was a very bad, very short-sighted option. And so throughout the first 10 chapters of Hebrews, he reminds them of how Jesus is so much better than the old covenant. He fulfills everything that the old covenant was pointing towards. Or to put it in terms that our marshmallow holders here might kind of more relate to, angels, Moses, the Levitical priesthood, the sacrificial system. You get that? That's like Hebrews in a nutshell, by the way. Jesus is better than all of that. So why would you want to go back? But you see, in today's passage, in chapter 11, the writer now changes tack. He goes through a brief history of the whole Old Testament, listing name after name of faithful followers of Jesus. People who resisted the temptation to fit in with the earthly societies around them in order to gain something of far greater value. Who didn't care about the empires like Egypt or Babylon because they were looking forward to God's empire. People who, if they'd been around in the first century, wouldn't have tried to fit in with their synagogue community or the Roman Empire. People who wouldn't have eaten their marshmallow now because their eyes were fixed on a city full of marshmallows that is to come. We'll read that chapter, chapter 11, in a moment. But just think for a second. It's not entirely unlike us, is it? I mean, our level of marginalization or persecution is nowhere near the level that the first century believers experienced. But still, we are increasingly made to feel like we don't belong, that we're out of step with the majority in terms of the way we view the world. And we're made to feel shame when we stand up for God's values in the world. We too face this temptation to eat our marshmallow now, to do what we need to do in order to fit in with our society, our city, rather than waiting for that city that is to come. At school, we might go along with our friends rather than living the way Jesus wants us to. As adults, we buy into the here and now focus of accumulating status and wealth and relationships and entertainment on demand rather than spending our time and our effort on things that are of eternal value. We spend too much of our time worrying about fitting in with the world rather than pleasing God. So despite our differences with the first hearers, the lesson for us is still the same. Don't eat that marshmallow now. Wait for something better. Now, I'm sure as I was going through that, you kind of know what your marshmallow is. You know the sorts of things that you're tempted to go along with rather than wait for the city that is to come. So I won't labour that, but keep that in mind as we read through Hebrews chapter 11 now against that background. Because, I mean, we could, if we had time, spend many, many weeks, I suppose, going through this chapter, reminding ourselves of all the Old Testament stories it refers to in detail. But for the original hearers of this sermon we call Hebrews, the stories were very familiar. They didn't need all that much rehearsing. And the effect of them really is the accumulation of stories rather than each individual one in isolation. So we're going to move through this pretty quickly. Chapter starts off with a definition of faith. It says, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. And the word there carries a bit more weight in Greek rather than in English. We've got a whole range of words we use in English depending on the context. We could translate it belief, trust, faith, loyalty. The people listed in this chapter are commended for their faith. They're commended for their belief in who God is. They're commended for their trust that God could deliver on his promises, no matter how outrageous they might have seemed. And people who put this trust into action through loyal obedience, despite the temporary consequences. In other words, they trusted God that there would be far more than just one additional marshmallow awaiting for them if they endured. This is what the ancients were commended for. And then we start this roll call of those who were faithful throughout the history of the Old Covenant. Verse 4, it says, by faith, or we could translate it in trust, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offerings. And by his faith, Abel still speaks, even though he's dead. Abel displayed a trusting, loyal, obedient response by giving the best of his produce to God, in contrast with his brother Cain, who kept the best for himself. He put loyalty to God ahead of temporary gain, ahead of keeping the best for himself, ahead of eating that marshmallow now. It says in verse 6, without faith, without this kind of faith, it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. We see faith is firstly belief in the existence of God. It's kind of fundamental. But secondly, you'll notice, it's trust. Trust that God is able to and that he will give that second marshmallow to those who are loyal, to those who earnestly seek him. And if you think I'm starting to be a bit repetitive, you haven't seen nothing yet. This is what Hebrews 11 is all about. Let's continue. By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that's in keeping with faith. What kind of fool builds a boat in his front yard for years, a giant boat, despite the scorn of all of his neighbours? The kind who trusts God that he knows what he's doing, who knows that loyalty to God pays off in the long term. And in the end, his neighbours were put to shame, munching on their soggy marshmallows as the floodwaters rose. Just like what will happen to those who are ridiculing you in the present for being loyal to God. Abraham, by faith, when called to go to a place where he would later receive as an inheritance, he obeyed and went, even though he didn't know where he was going. Imagine yourself as Abraham for a second. God tells you to leave your homeland, to leave your extended family, to leave everything that you have ever known and go somewhere you've never heard of. And despite not knowing God like we do, I mean, thanks to the Bible, we know God pretty well, don't we? We know him as the God who rescues people from slavery, who helps you across rivers in a hurry, who feeds you miraculously in the desert, gives you gracious laws, brings you into and then out of exile, becomes one of us, dies in our place, and then rises again to conquer death. You know, that God that we all know, despite Abraham not having any of that backstory, he obeys in trust and in faith. It says in verse 9, by faith he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. Maybe a bit like a Jew living in the Greek and Roman world in the Mediterranean. Well, like a Jesus follower whose primary loyalty is to God and not Caesar, whose primary allegiance is not as a citizen of their earthly city, but a citizen of their heavenly one. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. A greater city, greater than Rome, greater than Sydney, greater than any of the great cities of our world, one built by God himself, not by the might of any human empire. And by faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was enabled to bear children because she considered him faithful who had made the promise. So if we ignore the odd disbelieving laugh, Sarah too responded in faith. She trusted God despite the impossibility of the promise from a human perspective. And so she gave birth to a little baby marshmallow. And from this one man, he as good as dead, came as descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and countless as the sand and the seashore. Countless packets of marshmallows. Abraham and Sarah trusted in God's promise because they remained loyal to God while strangers in a strange land. Just like the first readers of Hebrews, and increasingly just like us today. Now we get a quick halftime recap. The writer says all these people were still living by faith when they died. They didn't receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. Even these great heroes of the faith we're talking about, they didn't see the fulfillment of their promise. They only got their down payment. Abraham, by the end of his life, the only part of the promised land he owned was his burial place. But they were looking forward to something beyond this life. Verse 14, people who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. People who acknowledge that they are foreigners and strangers. People who embrace the fact that they don't belong to the majority, they do so because they have a hope of a better place to call home. Makes sense, right? Otherwise, they just settle down and become a part of the city that they're in. If they'd been thinking of the country they'd left, they would have had the opportunity to return. But instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. And therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he's prepared a city for them. Instead, we see they remain loyal to God's promise of this greater dwelling place, a better city. And because of that, they remain loyal. Because they were not ashamed to be known as followers of God. And so he remained loyal to them. Here's one of the most astounding stories in the Old Testament. The next verse, it says, by faith Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, it's through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead, and so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead. It's all very well to believe that God could give you a son, and that through this son all the nations of the earth will be blessed. But in Genesis 22, that this verse refers to, this is where the rubber really hits the road. Abraham has to put his faith where his mouth is, his trust, his loyalty. He's told to go and sacrifice the very son through whom the promise was supposed to come about. It's like if I told you part of the way through this sermon to take your marshmallow and just go and throw it out the window. You think, well, that's crazy. Isn't that my ticket to the bonus marshmallow at the end? What are you telling me now? But Abraham was prepared to do that. He was prepared to sacrifice his son at God's command until God stopped him, telling him he'd passed the test. Abraham acted on his faith when it came to the crunch. Just like the first century followers of Jesus had to do when their reputations, their possessions, and even their very lives were at stake. And yes, we're back to that point again, aren't we? Going forward in history, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. By faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. Although Jacob had lived the final 17 years of his life in Egypt, he didn't want to be buried there. He trusted that God would one day give his family the land that he promised, and he made Joseph swear that he'd bury him there. Even as a wealthy man, even as the father of Egypt's prime minister, Jacob was still looking ahead to something greater. Same with his son Joseph. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions concerning the burial of his bones back in the promised land. Then we get to the well-known story of Moses. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. And they wouldn't be afraid of someone like Caesar either, just saying. And by faith, Moses, when he'd grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. You mean he wasn't interested in the status that he could get by joining with an oppressive foreign power? Like Rome, for example? No, he chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. Just like the first audience of Hebrews had been mistreated for belonging to God's people. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. A bit anachronistically phrased, I suppose, as Moses didn't know of Christ, but we get the idea, don't we? Temporary treasures of the world or long-lasting reward from God? Marshmallow now or much, much more later on? By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. He knew that God was more powerful than Pharaoh. By faith, he kept the Passover and the application of the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not destroy the firstborn of Israel. The stakes were high for Moses too, weren't they? Just like today. Do we remain faithful to God, or do we become like the world and join them in their journey that ends in destruction? So we've seen the example of Abraham and the other patriarchs. We've just had the example of Moses. Let's see who the next great hero of faithfulness is. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land. But when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho... Isn't this the story of the great leaders? You know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses. Surely Joshua is the next leader, right? Strange. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the army had marched around them for 7 days. A big fortified city got destroyed by God's power without so much as a siege ramp. Maybe trusting in earthly cities for security isn't all it's cracked up to be. Rome, we're looking at you. And Washington, Beijing, anywhere else we might look as a world power. And then by faith, verse 31, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. We have Rahab mentioned by name. She wasn't an Israelite, a reformed prostitute from Canaan. She's mentioned, but not Joshua. What's going on? Hopefully we're going to end on a better note than this, right? And what more shall I say? I don't have time to tell about Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, about David and Samuel and the prophets. No time? What about a quick summary of what they did then? Okay. Who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions and quenched the fury of the flames and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned into strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Fair enough, pretty impressive summary, but still, he had space for Rahab, but not for David and Samuel. Doesn't even mention the prophets like Elijah and Elisha or Isaiah and Jeremiah. It's a bit like Rahab is the climax of this impressive bit of speaking, isn't it? Or the apex before we climb back down the mountain. And I think that's for a reason. It's because Rahab had a very clear choice to make. If you know her story, she had to choose sides. With the advancing Israelite army ready to take the promised land, and she was in Jericho, she had to choose. Is she going to be loyal to her earthly city of Jericho, Or is she going to join with God's people and experience the blessing of being part of God's chosen people? And guess what happened? The earthly city of Jericho didn't endure. Its walls fell down. Just like the earthly cities of the first century didn't endure. Just like our own cities today won't endure. Just like it says a bit later on in chapter 13, for here we do not have an enduring city, but we are looking for the city that is to come. Rahab decided to save her marshmallow, and that paid off. And she went on living among God's people, experiencing his blessing. So let's put up with mistreatment by our fellow citizens, if it means getting that enduring city. Just like Rahab, and just like all of those other heroes of the faith that time wouldn't let us talk about in detail. Because there were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that it might gain not just a marshmallow, but an even better resurrection. Some faced jeers and floggings and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawn in two. They were killed by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, living in caves and holes in the ground. It's always been this way with the people of God. Because living by faith means foregoing that marshmallow of security in the here and now. So you'll get something far greater in the future. Something greater than even those Old Testament heroes we've been talking about experienced. Because the fulfillment of that promise still lies in our future. The writer concludes this chapter by saying these were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised, certainly not in full, because God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us, with the whole people of God, would they be made complete. These heroes of the faith didn't get what they were promised in this life. They're still waiting for that full second marshmallow. But still they remained loyal. Still they remained faithful. So having read this chapter in Hebrews, what impact should all of these stories have on us, do you think? Chapter 12, the writer starts off by saying, therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Imagine a stadium filled with people watching a sporting event like the ancient Olympic Games or the modern ones I've got up on the screen there. Except the crowd isn't just made up of tourists and armchair spectators, but the crowd is made up of people who have run the race in years gone by and won. The writer here is appealing to our sense of honour, saying with all of these past greats watching our performance, people who've been there and done that, how can we too not put in 100% and make it to the finish line like they did? How can we not resist the marshmallow sitting in our hands like they did? Those Old Testament heroes, they're part of our heritage. They're part of the group of people that we've now become a part of since we've followed Jesus. People who know that we are not at home in this world. People who live by faith, who live in trust, knowing that there is something far better in store than what this world can offer, and who choose to live like it. As Steve said before, not perfectly, but we are not part of the sleepwalking majority. We are part of the people of God, and we live differently, even if it means suffering in the here and now. And I suppose we could leave it there. A bunch of Old Testament stories we can go and look up later if we didn't know all the details and be reminded of how, yes, they gave up temporary acceptance in this life in order to gain something far better. But the writer doesn't stop there. He then starts talking about the climax of this series of examples, because it's not just the heroes of the Old Testament that they also ought to follow. It's the example of Jesus himself. It's that example that we're going to remember very soon when we come to communion. Reminds us of what Jesus has done for us so that we might follow his example as well. It says, let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faithfulness. If you want to run a race, particularly one that requires endurance, if you want to run a marathon, you don't focus on where you are, you focus on the finish line. You visualize the end in order to keep going to get there. But in this case, we're not talking about an empty finish line. In this image we're given, Jesus is standing there, having already finished the race, having already won, waiting for us to finish too. He's the pioneer, the one who's conquered the course, the one in whose footsteps we simply need to follow. And above all, it's his example, more than all of the others, that encourages us to keep going. And the reasons we're given are important. It says, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Two important things to note about this key sentence in Hebrews. Firstly, notice how Jesus followed the same pattern too that we saw throughout chapter 11. He endured hardship. He endured the cross, rejecting the kind of marshmallow on a stick held up to his lips when he could have called down a legion of angels to get him down. He endured in order to experience something greater, the joy set before him, as the writer to Hebrews puts it. And indeed, now he has entered into that greater experience. He now sits at the right hand of the throne of God. So if Jesus had to go through suffering and hardship in order to gain something greater, shouldn't we expect to do that as well? And given what he's done for us, bearing the punishment that should have been ours, how can we not follow him down that path? And secondly, Jesus scorned the shame of the cross. In an honor-shame world where your reputation was considered more important than health, wealth, or even life itself, in that kind of world, shame is a powerful force. Shame was how society would try to force weirdos like Jesus' followers back into conformity with everyone else. And one of the most shameful things imaginable in the ancient world was death by crucifixion. So by scorning this, by despising this shame, Jesus is setting an example for us. He treated his society's view of what was honorable with contempt. Why? Because he had God's values in mind. He said the world can think what it likes about crucifixion as being shameful, but in Jesus' mind, his death was honorable, because he was carrying out the will of God to bring forgiveness to others. In light of that example, the writer to the Hebrews wants us to think that same way. To despise the shame that our family or our society might pour on us for following Jesus. Realize that they just don't get it. It's God's definition of what's honorable and what's shameful that counts. Who cares what the world thinks? Despise the attempted shaming by those who are against you. Go outside the camp to bear the disgrace Jesus bore. If he bore the shame of the cross for you, how can you not bear the shame of being one of his followers? Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Jesus suffered for you. So if you happen to suffer for him, and let's face it, in Australia, we don't suffer that badly. But if you suffer for him, remember his example and keep going. In your struggle against sin, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Because he died for you. And so far, you haven't died for him. So the least you can do is resist that marshmallow.